All right. This is the session on migration and indentureship. And we're starting a little late, but we'll try to accommodate everybody. We'll begin with Professor Brinsley Samaru as the first presenter. He's, of course, an old friend of mine, and if I were to give him a proper introduction, it will take much longer than we have time for. So I'll just read quickly what I've been given, the statement I've given about him. Brinsley Samaru has been one of the iconic historians in Trinidad and Tobago, obtaining his Bachelor of Arts and his MA in History from Delhi University, and his PhD from the University of London. He has published extensively on the history of Trinidad and Tobago, with a specialty in working class movements, Indo-Caribbean history, and political and institutional development. Between 1987 and 1991, he was a Minister of Government. He served as head of the History Department at the University of West Indies, St. Augustine, and he has worked on numerous university committees. At present, he is Senior Research Fellow at the Academy of the University of Trinidad and Tobago for Arts, Letters, Culture, and Public Affairs. Brinsley will speak on comparing Indian diasporas.
Right, thank you very much, Frank. So much to say in so little time. So if I go a bit rapidly, you would understand. The first point I want to make is the continuing relevance of Tulsidas's Ramayana. Even in this conference that we have been having, so many people have been talking about the Ramayana and the way in which the Ramayana has influenced Indians of the diaspora. Gillian Clark was saying yesterday, telling us about a year-long Ramayana Yajna, which he said the people love. And she said it was easier to read than the other texts, and that's because Tulsi wrote in Avadi, which was one of the dialects in the Indo-Gangetic plain where he lived. And then Aitri was talking about the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and she was saying the Ramayana was far more important than Jangali Tola, about which she spoke. The Ramayana was far more important than the Mahabharata. And then Clem was talking, Clem Sicharan, last night and today again, of the Guyana stroke India of the Ramayana, that so much of the Indian life in Guyana was based on the Ramayana. And the film we saw last night, Tassa Thunder, derived so much of its content from the Ramayana, the New York Ramayana Goal, a New York circle that sings the Ramayana. The Sarwan Kumar dance, he was telling us in the film, comes out of the Ramayana. And the Biraha songs, these songs that they sing at Chetti and Barahi, come out of the Ramayana. And then Al Creighton, of course, spent so much of the lecture that we have just heard on dealing with so many different aspects of the Ramayana and the way it influences the culture, as he was talking about Guyana in such a serious way. So the Ramayana continues to be important. And in my own country, whenever a Hindu woman accuses her husband of philandering, of having too many women outside, he asks her two questions. Aren't you a Ramayani? Don't you go out singing Ramayana and you love the Ramayana? She says yes. And then he asks her, how many wives did King Dasharatha have? And that ends the argument. So she can't blame him. If she's a Ramayani, then she has to tolerate his philandering. So I want to go now into the way in which the Ramayana has influenced the philosophy, the way of thinking, the way of seeing of Indians in the diaspora. And I want to suggest that the frequency and widespread conferences that we have been having on the Indian diaspora since the 1970s in North America, in Europe, in India, and in the Caribbean, and I have no doubt that it will continue, because we have all been programmed into this spirit of inquiry by Sant Tulsidas' 1522 to 1623, not many of us know that he was a contemporary of William Shakespeare, and we are now in Shakespeare country. So Tulsi's voluminous writings set the tone and gave a philosophy to his mid-Gangetic compatriots, many of whom went abroad from the 19th to the 20th centuries, about their way of seeing. I'm going to tell you, Tulsi, how to see and how to interpret the world. Tulsidas came from the same Gangetic plains from which the majority of Indians were taken abroad, first by the Mughals, who transported them to West Asia, and later by the Europeans, who transported them to Mauritius, Fiji, the Caribbean, the Seychelles, and Natal. Equally, the Ramayana remains the major philosophical text for those who, in the 20th century, left India to go to North America and to Europe. And that influence over the centuries has so embedded itself into the biogenetic memory of all the Indians of the diaspora that Ramayana reading, recitation, and discourse is the commonest bond among the some 21 million Indians of the diaspora. The influence of Tulsidas is so significant because of the sound principles which characterize his writings, like his contemporary William Shakespeare. But unlike Shakespeare, Tulsidas sacralizes those principles, lifting them above the secular and into the divine, thus making them compulsory directives. And I would just like to give you one of these chaupais from Balakand, and I think this is crucial to the understanding of the Indian mind. Binu satsang viveka nahoi. Satsang is what? The search for truth. Binu satsang viveka nahoi. Without that search for truth, without that constant discourse, you will not become learned. Viveka nahoi. And then he goes on to sacralize the process of learning. Ramakripa bina sulabha nasoi. If you believe that you can do all of this intellectualism without including God, if you wanted to make a separation, sulabha, it's totally unimportant. Satsangati muda, mangala mula. Learning, when you are in the company of learned people, satsangati, when you are in the company of learned people, your fortunes become increased. Say, falsilisaba, sadhana, fula. Out of this, soy falsilisaba, out of that beating of learned mind, the fruit is your good works and sadhana fula, and out of your good works you get eternal life. And Indians have taken that very seriously. The importance of learning, the sacredness of learning. So today there's that compulsion to seek truth through discourse, and in Western society, that Indian urge has been matched by the same impulse in Western civilization coming out of the scientific revolution and the age of enlightenment, which equally stresses the importance of logic-led analysis, so that the West joins the East in this search for truth. And that is why we are here today, and that is why we will be continuing to be guided by Tulsi for the rest of our lives. And I think a very good book has been created out of this urge created by Tulsidas, by Amartya Sen. You must read it. It's called The Argumentative Indian, in which he talks about this Ramayanic motivation for Indians to deal with satsang all the time, this constant search for truth which creates the inquisitive Indian. So I will divide my presentation into two sections. The very first is pre-Ramayanic, that is, the Indian diaspora before the Ramayana, and then post-Ramayanic, That is after the 17th century. In the first period, that Indian diaspora has been characterized by the presence of Indian traders and holy men. Let me talk for just 2 minutes on the traders. By the 17th century, India had already been an ancient civilization with a wide trading network throughout Southeast Asia. Merchants from Gujarat, Malabar, Coromandel, and Bengal were well established in Burma, Thailand, the Malay Peninsula, Cambodia, Annam, Sumatra, Bali, Borneo, and the Celebes, taking from India precious metals, ivory, spices, coconut products, peacocks, and parrots. The Irrawaddy Delta in Burma and large areas of Java were colonized by these Indian merchants. Then India went west across the Indian Ocean, establishing settlements and clove plantations in Zanzibar, Mombasa, Kilwa. When Vasco da Gama reached East Africa in 1497, he hired a Gujarati sailor, Kanji, to lead him to India. And Kanji said, "Well, I'm going home if you want, just follow me." And so he came to Goa, and that was the beginning of the cattle industry in Brazil. That was the beginning of the cattle industry in Brazil. In December 2008, I met the Brazilian ambassador in New Delhi, and he claimed that Brazil still imports Indian breeds to improve its stock. So it started with Vasco da Gama's contact with India. It continues now in 2010. And then the Indian diaspora in this pre-Ramayanic period moved north. From the first century BC, there was active trade with the Roman Empire. In 325 BC, Alexander the Great was about to go on one of his Indian missions, and he asked his guru Aristotle, "What do you want me to bring from India?" And Aristotle said, "Bring me an Indian philosopher." And one of his generals, Nearchus, reported on the sweetness of Indian sugarcane and its abundance of cultivation in India. So that's the trading. Then there's the religious. Between the first and the seventh centuries, an elaborate Hindu culture was established in Java. Hindu art and architecture, theology and literature spread to the entire archipelago. Even today, Bali has a substantial Hindu population. And then 50 years after the death of Buddha in 483, Buddhist monks went to Southeast Asia. They got the patronage of kings, Asoka, whose Buddhist monks went to Central and Eastern Asia, and Kanishka, 1st century AD, who colonized South India, Eastern Iran, Central Asia, China, and Indonesia, spreading Buddhism in all of these areas. The Chinese philosopher Huan Tang visited Bihar, Nalanda University, 635 AD, and he said he found some 3,000 students doing a whole variety of subjects, most of whom had come from abroad. An integral part of that diaspora has been the movement of sugar. Sugar was developed by Indian geneticists in the Gangetic Plain. And when you look at the Sanskrit text, you see it referred to as Sakkargana. Out of Sakkargana, we get sugarcane. And it moved first to China, to the Yangtze Valley, and Nearchus, this general in 325 BC, as I said, spoke about the abundance of sweet sugar. And then in the mid-17th century, there was a Chinese delegation which came to Bihar to learn more about the sugar cultivation. And so from China into Oceania, into all those islands of the Pacific, from India to Arabia, to Iberia, into which there was the Moorish invasion of 711. And from Iberia, Christopher Columbus carried this Sakkargana first to the Northern Caribbean, 1493. And then the Portuguese, of course, took the sugar from Goa to Brazil, and then from Brazil into the Southern Caribbean, the Sugar Revolution. So that when the Indians started coming to the Caribbean or going to all of these areas where sugar was cultivated, all of these plantation colonies, we can say at least they had some, about 2,000 years of experience in cultivating sugar, and that is why the sugar revolution, wherever it took place, in Natal, in Fiji, in Mauritius, in the Caribbean, totally transformed these societies, because the Indians are working in a milieu and with a medium, with a plant in which they were totally accustomed. And then there is a post-Ramayan period of the Indian diaspora. And I've divided this into four sections. First of all, Indian indenture and convict labor to Mauritius, Natal, Reunion, Seychelles, Fiji, and the insular as well as the continental Caribbean. I would not talk about the convict legislation, but I'd recommend a book that I think is very excellent, Sea of Poppies by Amitabh Ghosh, in which he talks about the capturing of Indians or the punishment of Indians in eastern India by sending them as convicts to Mauritius. So, but this was mainly a labor migration. That's the first one. And then the 19th and early 20th century Punjabi migration to Canada and the United States. And this is not much written about. This is another labor migration. And then the mid-20th century migration to Europe and North America from India, trade, business, professional migration. And then the final one, late 20th century, remigration, second migration of diasporic Indians to North America and Europe. That is from Fiji to Western Canada, Australia and New Zealand, from Suriname to Holland, from East Africa to Europe and North America, and from the former British Caribbean to North America and Britain, moved by, of course, motivated by political and economic refugees, trade, and professional migrants. So the very first migration, the labor migration, I have a map that I prepared for. This is a map that demonstrated the movement of a particular ship, the Sheila, in 1877. And I made this map showing the voyage of the Sheila from India, south of South Africa. This is the area that is called the Pagal Samunda, the Mad Sea, in which the cold waters of the Antarctic are mixing with the warm waters of the Atlantic and Indian Ocean. And that's the most difficult part of the voyage, the Pagal. The Indians call it Pagal Samunda. And once you escape the Pagal Samunda, you came, your first stop was St. Helena, where Indians could get off only if they were to be put in jail or in the hospital. So that's the first stopping point where the ship got fresh water and so on. And this particular ship comes, drops its load of coolies in Trinidad, goes to Guyana, drops another load, and then goes back to Europe. So that is the voyage of the Sheila in 1877. And the voyage from India to the Caribbean took normally about 90 days. And that is important because these Indians who came lifted up economies that were faced by ruin, joins the Caribbean and Mauritius and Fiji and so on into the larger world of international trade. So those are the most important of that. And then I don't have too much of time to deal with the Sikhs in North America. I'll say a little bit about the 20th century migration to Europe and North America. A very different scenario emerges in the period after the Second World War and the independence of India and Pakistan. The achievement of independence enabled these South Asian nations to negotiate in their own right and no longer as colonies. Military service by Indians on behalf of the Allies during the war also created a favorable impression in North America. In addition, post-war reconstruction in Canada and the United States required skilled people who could assist in this reconstruction process. The post-1947 period therefore witnessed the granting of citizenship, familial reconciliation, and reciprocal visits. The election in 1956 of a Punjabi American Sikh to the U.S. Congress was not without symbolic significance, particularly to the Sikhs who had been subject to so many disabilities in the earlier period when they came. It was no wonder, therefore, that during the period 1966 to 81, no fewer than 216,000 Indians arrived in the USA at a rate of 14.376 a year, as compared to the rate of 303 per year in the previous 45 to 65 period. And in Canada, the DFN Baker government in 1962 removed most of the previous discrimination based on ethnicity and country of origin. So those are the major migrations, and I'm getting short on time. So I want to really address the questions, how have these various Indian diasporas, these various different kinds of Indian diasporas, ancient and modern, changed the world? First, I want to suggest the introduction of new ontologies worldwide: Hinduism, Indian Islam, and Buddhism. New ways of seeing. In Hinduism and Buddhism, there is a circular way of seeing, as opposed to Christianity and Islam, where it's a linear way. In Hinduism and Buddhism, there is no beginning and there is no end. There is a continuous circle. The idea of the indivisibility of life. There is no separation, both in Hinduism and Islam, between the religious and the secular. So Al Creighton was saying just a little while ago, that people are saying that you should not go and talk about Ram, and you couldn't carnivalize an Indian festival. And that is because everything is seen in a holistic way, no difference between the religious and the secular as we have in Western societies. What happens with the French Revolution is that there's a division between the church and the state. That division never took place in Oriental society, and therefore Hindus and Muslims continue to see life in a holistic way. Things cannot be separated. You cannot separate the political from the secular, the dramatic events from the religious. Everything is seen as one whole. There has been the continuous efforts throughout the diaspora at reconstitution of the family. It was very difficult at first, with very few women. During the indentureship period, the proportion was 33 women to every 100 men, and this was not observed, was not kept up all the time. And then, of course, with the Sikhs in Canada and the United States, it was even worse. They couldn't bring their wives, they couldn't marry Caucasian women, and so they had to marry Mexican women, and they created a race, which, if I had time, I would tell you about that whole race of Mexidus, Mexican Hindus. Later on, this is stabilized, and it becomes the basis for survival and continuity in the pre-Ramayanic and the post-Ramayanic period. And I want to say that even in the post-Ramayanic period, there are missionaries going from India, even in the post-Ramayanic period, going to the areas of the pre-Ramayanic diaspora and spreading the message of Tulsi and the Ramayana. And that is why the message of Tulsi and the Ramayana, the whole Ramcharitmanas, is so universal. The Indians transformed the plantation environment wherever they went, in Oceania, in Natal, or in the Caribbean, because the plantation system destroyed the environment. They had to cut the trees down either for fuel or to make way for sugarcane. So you had this very big canescape. The Indians created oases in these canescapes, little villages wherever they went. You see it in all of these Indian settlements, where they brought plants and animals from India, which were not in these areas before, and created these little oases, these little villages in the bleak plantation canescape, so that they brought all kinds of new things. The bainsa, for example, as a water buffalo, which replaces mule and donkeys on the plantations, and these animals are so much stronger. Zebu cattle, which revolutionized transport in the pre-tractor era. Fruits like mango, guava, jackfruit, bale, saijan, various kinds of spinach, bhaji, various kinds of dal, sarson, that's mustard, dhania, coriander, karapile, curry plant, nutmeg and mace, ginger, cloves, supari. Such a wide variety of animals and plants that we didn't have in these areas. One little point I want to make about something called the Jahaji Bandal, which is like a very big three-cornered handkerchief, which Indians were allowed to have and walk off the ship with that thing on a lathi, on a piece of stick, the Jahaji Bandal, which they took to Mauritius, which they took to Fiji, which they took to Natal, which they took to the Caribbean. And that Jahaji Bandal was remarkable, because that is where they brought these seeds, the rice seeds and the guava seeds, and the mango seeds, and all of these various spices, bringing them to these areas that they didn't have before them. The Indians, wherever they went, in the pre- or post-Ramayanic period, contributed to the diversification of national cultures by adding a host of new celebrations. Ral Creighton was just talking about some of these. I won't mention them. Oriental cuisine, of course, Oriental fashion, joining with other diasporas, Chinese, Jewish, African, Middle Eastern, in all of these areas to create a truly globalized world, breaking down national barriers and linking everybody inextricably together in a common culture, making the world a better place for all of us. So that these are the points I wanted to raise, and I hope I wanted to do a few more of the Dohas and Chaupais from the Ramayana to show you the roots of Indian philosophy, where it has been, but time has come on me, so you could possibly ask me some questions afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you.